We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Lots to cover this week, starting with we got a trifecta going here today. We will not reveal the other
the
good
other
news
stories
yet, but starting with a good story, Jay Inslee.
How often does that happen? Yeah. Some good news coming out of the state legislature this week. Governor Inslee signed a bill that would help people who were wrongfully convicted of a crime in Washington state and serve time. This law will compensate people who were wrongfully convicted, giving them about $50,000 for each year in prison, including time spent waiting for trial, and $25,000 for each year on parole in community custody or listed as a registered sex offender if they were wrongfully convicted. An additional $50,000 is available for each year a person has spent on death row. It was interesting to me that they could put a dollar figure on that. The state, well, says according to this law, the state will also reimburse child support costs while you were incarcerated, legal fees up to $75,000, and provide in-state college tuition for the person who was wrongfully convicted and for their children and their stepchildren, which is a pretty good step, I think, towards compensating people for what can be, you know, years and years of their life just stolen away from them.
And not just years and years stolen away, but it basically is a starter kit for people who have had their lives ruined.
Yeah.
Because people really do have to start over. And even if you've been exonerated, for example, going to employers and explaining why you didn't have a job for those 10 years. Well, I was in prison. Well, you know, and you can say you are wrongly convicted and exonerated all you want, and that's still going to impact how that person views you.
Yeah. And it's also an incentive to get public officials, public police agencies at the state and local level, judges, public prosecutors, to really do their best to get the right person convicted rather than just the most likely suspect.
All right. And as far as we know, has any other state ever done this?
I don't know.
Not that I've heard of, but I didn't see anything in the media accounts that suggested that. This was groundbreaking, or that other states had done it. I've not heard of any others. It's an unusual step, and you know, again, yeah, how do you put a price tag on something like that? You really can't. But just having the state on the record as saying we want to hold ourselves accountable, financially accountable for these kind of mistakes, and we want to acknowledge our debt, literally our debt, to people whose lives we've impacted in this way. There's no way that's not a good thing.
Yeah.
Moving on to sports news.
Yeah, this week, if we needed any further proof that Chris Hansen would be a really bad business partner for the city of Seattle, we got it this week when he announced that he and his other investors had voluntarily raised the valuation of the Sacramento Kings basketball team to $625 million. What this means is this is $100 million more over the way they had originally valued the team back in January when they made the offer and signed the deal with the Maloofs, the family that owns the 65% controlling share of the Sacramento Kings. That meant that back in January, they were basically saying, well, to buy out the Maloofs' majority share, we are willing to pay 65% of $525 million, which is $341 million. And by voluntarily raising the valuation $100 million, they're basically saying, well, we're willing to give you an extra $65 million. Over and above what we signed the deal for, in order for you to say, yes, I'm going to sell the team to you. I find that to be pretty crazy myself. I mean, when do you look at a situation like the situation that Hansen and co are in, and instead of saying, well, doesn't look like we're going to be able to relocate the team, so we're walking away from this deal, a sane business person or a sane investor would do, and instead say, oh no, I'm going to voluntarily give you guys an extra $65 million in order to continue my war with the NBA and Sacramento to try to purchase the Sacramento Kings and get them up here.
I think I'm going to disagree with you on that, because disagree with the idea that it's insane. This is a legal strategy, because there is no way the NBA is going to approve this sale.
And I know.
We've talked about it for several reasons, the most obvious of which is they don't want to set a precedent of non-public financing for an arena deal. You know, literally, you know, it's not an ideal deal for Seattle taxpayers, but it's actually a much better deal than most city taxpayers get when these kind of arena things are held hostage over taxpayers in different cities. And the NBA, which like most men's team leagues, the four major ones in North America, their business model now is predicated on the idea that taxpayers will pay for the venues for all of these teams. They don't want to set the precedent, and what the Maloofs in particular, and Chris Hansen is helping them do it, and this may well have been a strategy agreed upon well ahead of time, they're going to sue the NBA for restraint of trade. The Maloofs are going to say, we should be able to sell the team for whoever we want to. We've got this offer that's worth, you know, at this point, you know, $150 million more than what is being offered by this other group, and the NBA is not allowing us to sell to this much higher offer. And making it a much higher offer like that, it's still not, you know, they're not putting any money up. They're just making the offer, and the offer is going to be stopped by the NBA, and they're going to sue on that basis. And they will probably lose the suit, because I'm sure that the affiliation agreement with the NBA, however that's worded, gives the NBA the right to control things like this. But they're gonna pursue that legally, and they're gonna try and win.
Yeah, it's not true that they haven't put up any money.
I'm saying they're not gonna put up additional money with this offer.
Because I know that they've got a deposit. I think it's about $50 million
on
the team.
$30 million non-refundable.
Yeah.
But the additional offer that came up this week does not involve their putting down any additional money. It's
at
a paper
this
offer.
Point. Yeah.
It's a paper offer.
At this point,
they're only on the hook for it if they actually win a court case, or if the NBA actually allows the sale to proceed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you could argue too that Hansen is making this offer to try to increase the valuation of not just the Sacramento Kings, but to increase the valuation of other NBA teams, and in that sense, trying to win over other NBA owners who will be voting on whether or not to allow the Sacramento Kings to move.
Yeah, the other owners are torn between not wanting to set the precedent of teams being moved to other cities through bidding wars, through having higher offers on the one hand, but they still want the freedom to be able to sell to whoever they want to,
and to sell at a higher amount than they've ever historically seen.
Yes, so it's either way that it goes, it puts them in a difficult position, and that's exactly what Hansen's trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Finally, briefly, Seattle Times.
Yeah, interesting item in Slog, the Strangers blog today, and where they verified that one of the side effects of the new paywall at the Seattle Times is that reporters and newsroom employees for the Seattle Times now also have to pay the paywall if they do not already have home subscriptions to the Times. Now, they get it at what Times editor David Boardman says is a deeply discounted rate, but it still means that if, say, I'm a reporter and I want to go back into the archives to fact check something or provide context for the story that I'm writing, I have to pay for it out of my own pocket, which tells you a couple things. Number one, it tells you that the Blethyn family, which owns the Times, is desperate for money and or extremely greedy. And number two, that they seem to consider things like context and fact checking and, you know, the history of a particular issue to be, and imparting that as part of a news story to be outside a reporter's job description of stenography. It really tells you how pathetic the Seattle Times has become. And why, putting up a paywall is shooting themselves, I wouldn't say in the foot, I'd say more like in the face, because there's no content there. And policies like this are exactly why there's no content there, because the reporters don't have the freedom to do their job properly, because they're not getting paid enough that they can retain decent reporters, and because they've laid off so much of their newsrooms.
On to national, starting with sexual assaults in the military.
Oh, yeah. It's sexual assault week at the Pentagon. Again, seems like this comes around about every two or three months.
It's not sexual assault decade.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, really, with the release of this new Pentagon survey, it turns out it's sexual assault week every week at the Pentagon. This survey was given by the Pentagon to a couple hundred thousand men and women in uniform. About 25,000 of them responded, saying that Of those respondents, about 6.1% of women and 1.2% of men said that they were sexually assaulted in the past year. Now, extrapolating that over the 1.4 million members, men and women, in the military, the Pentagon survey came up with a total of about 26,000 servicemen and women who were victims of sexual assault just in the past year. That's a pretty horrific number for a one-year total, and it's higher than it's ever been.
And how does that number compare with the number that are actually reported or prosecuted?
Well, that's the interesting thing, because in the same week this week, the Pentagon released their official report to Congress, where they counted only 3,374 actual reports of sexual assault. That's only about 13% of the 26,000 estimated total. Now, I think Congress really needs to get active here and say we have to pass legislation. They have to ignore, first of all, the advice from Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel, who says, oh, no, let's not be hasty. Let's not change the way things are done at the Pentagon. They need to ignore that, and they need to pass a law that allows victims of sexual assault in the military to have their own attorneys, first of all, and secondly, the right to have their cases tried in a civilian court, not just have a higher ranking officer evaluate hear their claim versus the claim of their attacker, and then decide that, well, I need to err on the side of caution and allow the attacker to keep their job and to have a minor administrative punishment.
Yeah, and bear in mind, when you have something that's endemic, it's not just a matter of, you know, particular commanders or particular units or a particular service. It's a cultural problem throughout the armed forces.
Definitely is. And we saw that again this week, too, because, you know, the Air Force, which has been under a heavy cloud now of scandal because of repeated sexual assaults, it had set up a new group called the Sexual Assault Prevention Unit, and it appointed a guy named Lieutenant Colonel Jeffrey Kruzinski to head up this new unit. He's had the job for about 2 months. Well, this week he was caught by the Arlington County Police, sexually assaulting a woman in a dark parking lot after having gotten drunk. And he was arrested and put in jail. And the Arlington County prosecuting attorney said that she was going to bring this case to trial. Well, some Pentagon brass came over and tried to persuade her to give up Kruzinski and to let them take over the case and let it be handled by a military court. And
even though it didn't happen on military grounds.
It did not happen on the base. It happened off the base. And she said, my court regularly prosecutes military members for other crimes. And this is a direct quote. She said, in my 26 years, I have never been asked by the government to turn over a member of the military. It doesn't make sense. Well, if you're a serviceman or a servicewoman who's been sexually assaulted in the military and you've had your case ignored or buried or swept under the carpet, it makes perfect sense to you, because there's different standards in the military when it comes to a high-profile case like this. And they definitely are not playing by the rules of a democratic society.
Not just that it's a high-profile case, but there's different standards when it comes to this type of case,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah, just a sexual assault type of case.
All right. Moving on. Rust Consulting. Who is Rust Consulting?
Rust Consulting
is... It never sleeps.
They'd like you to think that. Rust Consulting is the company that was appointed by the U.S. government to handle the payout of settlement funds from the big foreclosure settlement with banks. Now, as folks will remember, the big banks were caught by the federal government or sued by the federal government for having done these massive foreclosure abuses against people who were having their homes foreclosed on without allowing them to modify their loans, not processing the paperwork properly, for robo signing documents, for not having copies of the correct paperwork and proof that they actually own the mortgages they were foreclosing on, etc. So as part of the settlement agreement, the big settlement agreement that was reached about a year, maybe 2 years ago, I think it was about I think it was about a year and a half ago. They reached a settlement and were going to pay out, you know, millions of dollars to people who had been victims of foreclosure abuse. Well, Rust Consulting, about 3 weeks ago, they started to send out the first checks. Well, those first checks, a number of them bounced because Rust Consulting hadn't transferred several hundred million dollars into the correct account. Apparently, they were playing the stock market or trying to collect a little extra interest on that money before they had to pay it out. This is how a private company functions. Now,
isn't privatization great?
Yeah, I know. Now they were caught again this week for issuing checks in the wrong amount. Apparently, they were using the wrong equation to calculate how much money to pay out to victims of foreclosure abuse, leaving many people collecting only a pittance. Versus the thousands of dollars they were owed.
Oh, I thought you meant like they got too much.
No, they got too little. Yeah. And in addition, they've been caught incorrectly calculating the amount to pay military members whose houses were wrongfully foreclosed on while they were under deployment. Instead of getting the tens of thousands of dollars that they were owed, they've been getting a few hundred dollars instead. Again, erring in favor of Rust Consulting.
By a factor of about 100.
Yeah. And in addition, they don't provide any information to recipients of the checks so that they can see how their compensation was calculated. So many people may be getting much less than they're owed, but they don't even know about it.
Yeah. The calculation in this case is that many of the people who are wrongfully paid these pittance amounts won't actually appeal that.
Because they don't know.
And then Russ can actually pocket the money.
Yeah, or who knows what they're going to – or just hold on to it a little longer and collect a little more money on it. Now, I think the federal government needs to take it back in-house and say this whole privatization scheme is just gone wrong. And even though it may be a little bit slower than in issuing the checks, at least there'll be some kind of public oversight.
Mm-hmm. All right. Moving on. Follow up to last week's talk about Plan B.
Yeah, we talked last week about the Department of Justice and the Obama administration appealing the court ruling on the availability of Plan B emergency contraception to girls under age 15. Now, the context for this was that the scientific panel of the FDA had approved Plan B for females of all ages, but then Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius, an Obama administration political appointee, overruled the scientific panel and said, no, under age 15, girls can't have this, in what was clearly a very political decision made in the context of a presidential election last year. Well, that went to court, and the federal court in that case had ruled against the Obama administration and said, no, the FDA scientists were right. And then we talked last week about the Obama administration having appealed that and claiming in the course of that appeal that the judge had overstepped his boundary by not agreeing with the scientists, when in fact he was agreeing with the scientists. And we were pretty critical of the Obama administration last week for doing that, but the judge himself in the case, Judge Edward R. Corman of the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of New York, made our criticisms sound kind of mild when he ruled yesterday rejecting the Obama administration's appeal for a stay in this case. Quote, if a stay is granted, it will allow the bad faith, politically motivated decision of Secretary Sebelius, who lacks any medical or scientific expertise, to prevail, thus justifiably undermining the public's confidence in the drug approval process. That's from the decision that Corman wrote. It's long, it is scathing, it is well worth reading. He wrote that if the stay is granted, it would, quote, vindicate the improper conduct of the secretary. He called the Department of Justice's arguments silly and frivolous. And he made another point that we didn't get to last week, which is that requiring an age limit for something that's medically appropriate for all ages also forces young women and girls to show ID proving their age, so that even girls 15 and older who need the emergency contraception but cannot prove their age because they don't have government-issued photo ID, for example, a driver's license that they're not old enough to get, also can't get the emergency contraception or cannot get it in time. And that this also discriminates disproportionately against poorer women and women of color.
And immigrant women as well. Don't have a legal ID in the United States.
Mm-hmm. He rejected the stay. The Department of Justice again is trying to appeal that and is going on Monday to a larger panel in the same district court. But it once again underscores how politically motivated this decision was by Sebelius, that it goes against not only common sense and science and social justice, and also if you believe the public opinion polls, the desires of about 2/3 of Americans that this be made universally available. You have to ask yourself why they're pursuing this at this point. It's not a political calculation for the election. The election is over. So what exactly is the deal here?
Finally, on national, the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah. House Majority Leader John Boehner and Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell announced this week that they were going to refuse to make recommendations for the House and Senate appointees to the Independent Payment Advisory Board. That's the part of Obamacare that is set up. It's a 15-member panel that's supposed to be set up next year to look for cost savings in Medicare payouts to providers. It does not have the authority to make any recommendations and cuts to benefits, but it's looking ways to cut costs. And this is a 15-person panel. The White House appoints three, and then three each come from the majority and minority party in each House of Congress. What the Republicans are saying is we're not going to appoint even nominate our six, and they're also looking to those appointees then have to be confirmed by the Senate, and chances are very good, judging from this and from statements that have been made, that Senate Republicans are also going to try and certainly have the votes to block any nominations from happening. Now, what's particularly interesting about this is that the way the Affordable Care Act is written, if for any reason the Independent Payment Advisory Board cannot do its job, for example, if all the nominations have been appointed, then it falls to Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius, who we were just talking about, to make those decisions herself. There's a lot of political calculation going on behind this. What the Republicans are doing here, number one, they're preventing the Obama administration from being able to make bipartisan cuts to the cost, because they're trying, and then turning around and trying to accuse Obamacare of costing money, which it doesn't do, but they will make the case that these cuts are not being made without mentioning that they're not being made because, you know, they blocked all the appointments to the panel. They're also going to make the case that it's the tyranny of federal government, and in this case, one woman making the decision, when in fact the reason that it's not being made by a more representative body is, again, because they've blocked the nominations. And finally, the way this happens is it sets up the precedent so that the next time a Republican is in the White House, which, unless the party disbands, we can always hope, will happen sooner or later. The idea is that then the Republican political appointee to that position would simply dismantle the entire process and have the precedent, because the precedent has been set that they have control over the process. It's the exact same thinking behind why you have Republican governors in these different states refusing to set up health care exchanges and thus devolving it to the federal government to come into the states and set them up. They can then point to the overreach of the tyrannical federal government doing the state's businesses, and then also when a Republican is in the White House, they can simply dismantle the programs for the different states. So they're trying very hard to implement what is on the books as a legal law passed by Congress and signed by the president. They're really trying very hard to obstruct the law in this case, and they're doing it for nakedly partisan political reasons, and they're doing it on an issue where even if they're not successful, the delays that are caused and the confusion that is caused by this kind of obstruction is going to cost lives, and they know it's going to cost lives. They don't care.
All right. On to international and Syria.
Yeah, Syrian rebels may have used sarin gas. Now, I'm really glad that we heard some coverage earlier this morning of the Syrian claims that the Syrian government had used sarin gas against civilians and against the rebel units, and those were debunked on Counterspin. I'm really glad you played that this morning because I was surprised to read that headline. Syrian rebels may have used sarin gas buried deep in the international section of the New York Times this week. Turns out that the United Nations Independent Commission of Inquiry on Syria has found what it thinks is very convincing evidence that sarin gas was used during the fighting in Syria, but not by the government. It was used by the rebels.
Which raises the interesting question of where they got it.
Yeah, it does. And I'm not surprised by it because, you know, some military installations in Syria have changed hands more than once in the fighting. It's been that bad there, particularly around some of the military installations. Now, this UN commission investigated by interviewing people in field hospitals and refugee camps and interviewing both the victims and the doctors, and they feel that they're pretty certain that sarin gas was used. And I just want to remind people that some of the most effective fighting units in the Syrian rebel forces are run by jihadis, guys who have never shown any compunction about targeting civilians for attacks in order to try to overthrow the government or to promote the setting up of a Islamic government. So I wouldn't be surprised if they did decide to use some chemical weapons.
And I underscores a couple other things pretty quickly because we want to get to other items. One is that for all of the calls for U.S. intervention and military intervention in this, there are no sides that are allied with the United States in this civil war. The people among the rebels who might be sympathetic to American interests have been marginalized in the rebel movement, especially since it became an armed struggle quite some time ago. Secondly, this gives rise to all sorts of possible conspiracy theories also about, whose interest in it is it for chemical weapons to be used and then for it to be blamed on the Syrian government?
Yeah.
And, there are lots and lots of different players with intelligence agencies and people on the ground in this conflict, and a lot of misinformation. So people should be skeptical about anything that they read and hear attributed to anybody right now.
All right. And finally, very briefly, Rios Montt.
Yeah. General Rios Montt, the former dictator of Guatemala, was convicted yesterday afternoon and sentenced to 80 years in prison for genocide for his oversight of the killing of hundreds of thousands of the Ixil Mayans in the highlands of Guatemala in the 1980s. This is really the first time that a country has convicted its own previous leader of these types of crimes against humanity. And it came only because the current president of Guatemala, who was an ally of an underling of Rios Montt during those dirty wars in the 1980s, was very carefully kept out of the proceedings that he even allowed them to go forward at all. So it was a very politically charged event. The other thing that was really not present at all this morning and last night in U.S. media coverage of this verdict was that Rios Montt was doing the bidding of Ronald Reagan that whole time. Reagan, in fact, heralded Montt as a friend of democracy. And, most of the arms and most of the weapons and money used to facilitate that genocide came from Washington, D.C. We very much have blood on the hands as U.S. taxpayers for that verdict in Guatemala that has happened. And there has been justice there, but there's still very little accountability for the U.S. foreign policy mechanism that still prioritizes that kind of response to perceived threats to U.S. interests.
All right. Events?
Tuesday, the 14th, 3:30 to 6:30 p.m., there will be a rally to save Indian Heritage School, which, like most alternate schools in alternative schools in Seattle, has been jacked around by the school district for several years. The Indian Heritage is now facing closure entirely by the school district. A rally to protest that. Bring your signs, drums, and voice. It's at the John Stanford Center for Excellence in Despising the Public, a.k.a. the Glass Palace, at 2445 3rd Avenue in SoDo, 3rd Avenue South. Also at 3:30 on Tuesday the 14th will be an open house, and 4 o'clock, the beginning of testimony. The King County Council's Transportation, Economy, and Environment Committee is going to be holding a public hearing on budget cuts to public transportation in the face of the impending 17% budget cuts to Metro. That'll be at Union Station at 401 South Jackson in Seattle. On Wednesday, May 15th, hundreds of Puget Sound nonprofits are participating in the Seattle Foundation's annual Give Big Day for online donations. So your favorite groups are probably involved in that. There's a match involved from the Seattle Foundation, so it's a good time to give to your favorite nonprofits. And then on Thursday, May 16th at 7 o'clock, City Council candidate Kishama Sawant will be the featured speaker in the last episode for this spring of the Common Good Cafe. That's 7 o'clock at the University Temple United Methodist Church, 15th and 43rd Northeast in Seattle's U District.
All right, talking as we do every week with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org. And once again, we'll have the notes up on this week's stories and a couple that we didn't get to within the next 24 hours or so.